Please stand by. We're about to begin.
Okay.
Hello. Children's Brain Tumor Foundation and Childhood Brain Tumor Foundation are thrilled to work collaboratively to bring you an educational webinar series related to pediatric central nervous system tumors. This one-hour discussion answering commonly asked questions will be presented by national expert in the field, Dr. Peter C. Berger, Professor of Pathology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. We welcome you to this presentation and hope you find this a helpful way to gather critical information about the diagnosis of pediatric central nervous system tumors. We extend our great appreciation to Dr. Berger for his willingness to share his knowledge with us today on this complex topic. Thank you. Dr. Berger, would you like to begin?
Yes, and I'd like to say hello to the audience, the listeners, and largely parents I know, and share with you some of my perspectives on pediatric tumors of the brain and spinal cord. I am a neuropathologist. It's my job to diagnose tumors basically with a microscope and tell the oncologists, surgeons, family, etc., what type of tumor it is, and make some estimate as to how slowly growing or rapidly growing it may be. And what I'm going to schedule this talk as answering a series of questions, which I think are, I hope, representative questions that you may have or have had about your child and the tumor. The first question I suspect most of you ask is, why my child? Did I or we do something to make this happen? It's a logical question, but with rare exceptions, the answer is, well, you didn't do anything to make it happen or did not do anything to make it happen. In spite of all we know or we think we know about these tumors in terms of their appearance under a microscope and their DNA abnormalities, we really don't know what causes them. Some of these arise really during the fetus. Others appear to occur later in life, but the real mechanisms are not clear. There are occasional cases where prior radiation therapy is the cause of a brain tumor, a second brain tumor, but this obviously is quite uncommon. So the answer to this first question is no, and the second one, did you do anything to make it happen? Also no. Another question is, well, how do we determine what this tumor is and make some estimate as to how it will behave? And that is done in part by the clinical history. Tumors, for example, that have been there for a long time may be presumed to be relatively slowly growing, or ones that arise and seem to grow rapidly clearly are more rapid in their evolution. But the diagnosis in most cases is based on the pathologist's review of tissue, which is removed by the neurosurgeon. Now, is that diagnosis based on the pathology study in all cases? In other words, is an operation necessary before some sort of treatment like radiotherapy or chemotherapy is given? In all cases, the answer is no. Almost always, but not always. There are certain cases like astrocytomas or gliomas of the brainstem, which are so typical in the radiological and clinical features that a biopsy is usually not undertaken. Most of the time, however, the tissue is removed in part to remove the mass effect or lessen the mass effect, but also to obtain tissue for the pathologist's study. And that involves really determining what the tumor is, making an estimate as to how aggressive or not aggressive it is, and then in some cases, evaluating whether the lesion has spread or not. So the question then is, well, how do we classify these tumors? And the question you might ask is, well, where do they come from? Pathologists try to classify brain tumors on the basis of the cell of what they arise from. This may not be exactly true, but this is the way we operate. In other words, we look at a lesion and say, well, what cell of the brain does this represent? What cell of the brain has gone haywire here and is proliferating into a neoplasm or a tumor? So the question is, what are the normal cells of the brain? There are, of course, neurons that we think with and move our arms and legs with. There are other cells that act somewhat as insulation around these cells. There are others which are somewhat supportive cells. And, of course, there are blood vessels and coverings, etc. So each of these cell types can be the site or the source of a tumor. some cell types frequently become tumorous, whereas for unknown reasons, other cell types rarely become proliferate to become a neoplasm. So the pathologist's job then to look at the specimen with a microscope and make an analysis of, well, what normal cell does this tumor look like? And having done that, then we proceed with the next step, is just to get some estimate as to how this will be proliferating, or how rapidly proliferating, or how slowly growing it may become, based on past experience and some special techniques. So we analyze these, and generally speaking, in children, they come into certain groups. One large group of brain tumors is known as a glioma. And the question is, well, what is a glioma? Well, a glioma is a neoplasm, a tumor that is derived from glia. Glia are, in some respects, supporting cells. They're not neurons, and they're not blood vessels. They're an intrinsic cell in the brain. For whatever reasons, these are a fairly common source of tumors. Gliomas come in different categories. Many of you will have heard the term astrocytoma. And the question is, well, what is that? Well, that is one type of glioma. Glia are astrocytes, and there's another cell type known as the ependymal cell, which lines the brain, and that gives rise to an ependymoma. Examples of astrocytomas are, one would be a brainstem glioma. This is a reasonably common form of astrocytoma in the pediatric age group, and for some reason it very typically arises in one part of the brainstem. And it is actually an astrocytoma of the brainstem, but the name brainstem glioma is commonly applied. You will hear ask, what is the pilocytic astrocytoma, or sometimes abbreviated JPA for juvenile pilocytic astrocytoma. The word pilocyte refers to hair cell, because the cells of this particular tumor are very long and thin, and under the microscope resemble a strand of hair. Optic nerve glioma is a fairly common lesion in children, and this is a pilocytic astrocytoma, obviously arising in the optic nerve or optic chiasm. The pilocytic astrocytomas, as we'll talk about later, are, generally speaking, a slowly growing tumor, which in some areas are amenable to total excision. The common form of cerebellar astrocytoma is usually, or almost always, a pilocytic neoplasm. You may ask, well, what is this pilomyxoid astrocytoma? Well, this has been just recently classified by the World Health Organization as a variant of the pilocytic astrocytoma. It is remarkable that for its incidence, predominantly in very young children, infants in some cases, and it appears that it may be somewhat more aggressive, more likely to spread than the common, ordinary pilocytic astrocytoma. Another form of astrocytoma is the PXA, which is an acronym for pleomorphic xanthoastrocytoma, which is a long way of saying that the cells are pleomorphic, that is, they are vary quite a bit in size and shape. The xantho means that some of these cells have fat in them, and the A, of course, is astrocytoma. This is often a fairly slowly growing lesion, which in some cases can be totally excised. What is a ganglion cell tumor? These are gangliocytomas or gangliogliomas, but the significance is that they are composed largely of ganglion cells, which are neurons. Neurons usually don't give rise to brain tumors, but they certainly can, and this is the type that usually arises in children. What is a craniopharyngioma? Well, a craniopharyngioma is a somewhat odd lesion that usually occurs near the base of the brain. And why it should occur there is not clear, but it is a reasonably common pediatric tumor, which can be excised, although the location makes this difficult in some instances. You will hear the term PNET, which is acronym for primitive neuroectodermal tumor. And the question is, what is that? Well, the primitive neuroectodermal tumor is a common, relatively, form of brain tumor in children, which is composed of cells which are rapidly proliferating. And these lesions have a risk of spreading in the throughout the brain, and as a result, treatment often or usually includes radiation therapy to much of the nervous system. Treatment of many other lesions is confined in terms of radiation therapy to the area of the tumor itself, but this lesion has a high risk of spreading, so the oncologist usually will treat such a lesion with radiation throughout the brain and spinal cord. The common variety of lesion, which may or may not be classified as a PNET, but has the same properties, is the lesion which is, you well know, is medulloblastoma. Medulloblastoma occurs by definition in the cerebellum. It is almost always a pediatric tumor, but incidentally does every so often show up in adults. It is a aggressive lesion left to its own devices, but its treatment has been one of the success stories in neuro-oncology, so it's in favorable situations. 70, maybe even 80% of patients with this lesion can be cured using a postoperative radiotherapy and, in many cases, chemotherapy as well. The medulloblastoma has become of great interest to oncologists, since it would appear that this is really not one neoplasm, but multiple neoplasms in one. Historically, neoplasms were classified by pathology features, as we would see with a microscope, but of course, with the new information, there is an increasing tendency to classify tumors on the basis of their so-called molecular features. That is to say, the abnormalities in the DNA, in the chromatin, in the nucleus of the cell, that really makes these tumors happen, or makes them progress in a certain way, or makes them resistant or susceptible to certain treatments. The medulloblastoma is a good example of a scientist's ability to dissect tumors into subtypes based on their molecular features, in addition to, or in, perhaps instead of, the classic features that someone like myself would identify with a microscope. So accordingly, the medulloblastomas are divided now on sort of these new features, and there's exciting evidence that some of these features can be used to select therapies, and we hope cure these patients with a minimal amount of toxicity. Another common, relatively, recognizing that pediatric brain and spinal cord tumors would not be considered common in one sense, is the ependymoma. This is a lesion that is derived from the cells that line the brain and spinal cord. You may not think of the brain as hollow or the spinal cord as hollow, but as the brain develops as in the embryonic life, in the fetal life, it is indeed hollow, and the brain, even in the adults, remains hollow, filled with fluid or cerebrospinal fluid. And this surface of the brain is covered by this layer of cells. In the spinal cord, the lesion, the structure is not hollow in adult life, but these cells remain and can be the source of neoplasms. So ependymomas occur toward the center of the brain or the spinal cord and are a common issue in pediatric neuro-oncology. The lesions are, generally speaking, slowly growing. They are well-defined or well-circumscribed, and that would make them an ideal candidate for surgical excision and cure. However, the lesions are not infrequently located in difficult positions, such as the brainstem, and the surgeon has to be careful in excising these lesions not to damage or to damage as little as possible the surrounding tissues. So it's a delicate balance between being aggressive in attempts to remove these lesions in toto versus the possibility that in so doing, valuable nervous tissue is removed or damaged in the process. So there are increasingly sophisticated neuroimaging or MR techniques and surgical techniques to facilitate as total a resection as it can be done with safety. Now, a frequent question comes up, and I know you all are asking or likely to ask, well, is my child's tumor benign or malignant? And this is one of the most important but at the same time difficult questions to answer. These are, in a sense, lay terms. They're not precise medical terms, but of course they're critical terms as to you as parents. Malignancy is perhaps easier to define than benignity. A malignant tumor in all of its aspects is something that grows rapidly. It invades or involves the surrounding tissues, making it difficult to remove, and that it spreads to other body sites. In adults, the common examples of spreads to other sites would be breast cancer that would spread to the lungs or brain or bone. Colon cancer frequently spreads to the liver. So this is distant spread, and that by definition is a quality of a malignant tumor. In the nervous system, this spread does happen. Medulloblastomas, for example. But the spread is usually within the nervous system, in the cerebral spinal fluid, to the spinal cord, for example. Not usually to other organs, although that certainly can happen. So we would assume that a lesion that has spread elsewhere is a malignant tumor, although there are circumstances where once having spread, the lesion quiets down and really grows very little. So even when they spread, the definition of malignancy can be a bit vague, and it depends really entirely on the situation at hand, the specific child and specific tumor as to what is really malignant and what is not. The definition of benign is less obvious. Let's assume one had a very well circumscribed lesion in an organ, say, let's say the liver, for example, and the surgeon can remove it entirely. The liver, after all, is more than enough to go around. It can actually grow back. So a fairly generous excision of this lesion can be done to be sure that the tumor is all removed. The ability to do that, of course, in the central nervous system is a bit constrained. There are certainly some areas like the cerebellum, for example, that surgeon can be fairly aggressive and remove the whole specimen with the feeling that this will not produce serious neurological deficit. Otherwise, rather slowly growing lesion like a pilocytic astrocytoma or a JPA that involves the optic chiasm or the base of the brain is really often not excisable without producing unacceptable deficit. Some high-grade lesions like medulloblastomas appear to be largely removed. So it's a lesion that grows rapidly but can be, in concept, removed largely, if not entirely, by the surgeon. On the other hand, the pilocytic astrocytoma, which is a slowly growing lesion, benign in that sense, may be in such a location as to ultimately recur and in that sense be biologically malignant. So it really depends on the situation at hand, the lesion itself, the particular type, particular child, and especially the particular location of the lesion as to whether this would be considered benign or malignant. So given these uncertainties, we tend not to use the terms malignant so much except for the high, very aggressive lesions, which we can be certain that that's a very good descriptor. The way that this is done by pathologists is not to use those terms, but rather to grade the lesion. And by grading, I mean assigning a number from 1 to 4, which estimates how aggressive this lesion is, basically, prior to treatment, and to make some prediction of what may happen. Grades are given Roman numerals, and it's based on a classification system which has evolved really since the early 1900s, and the principal one is now sanctioned by the WHO, or the World Health Organization. This is a group which meets every so often. It just met last week in Heidelberg, Germany, to come to consensus on the appropriate grades of the various brain tumors, both in children and in adults. So what do these numbers mean? Well, starting at the upper end, grade 4 is a rapidly growing, almost always invasive or infiltrating lesion with the tendency to spread in some cases, but one which short without treatment and in some cases even with treatment is a rapidly progressive. At the other end of the spectrum, we have grade 1 tumors, which are very slowly growing, sometimes growing little, if at all. These may be, in some cases, well circumscribed, easily removed, but other cases not. The outcome of these patients depends on the growth rate, but as we've indicated before, where the lesion is. The location of the lesion is highly important in establishing what treatments can be done and what need to be done, and ultimately the prognosis. Grade 2 lesions are, as you can imagine, somewhat more proliferative, that is, they grow more rapidly than the grade 3 lesions, than the grade 1 lesions. The grade 3 lesions are usually considered, in the general sense, malignant gliomas, and we'll come back to that in a minute, or malignant neoplasms, which, generally speaking, require some form of postoperative treatment, i.e., radiotherapy and chemotherapy. Now, how do we go about evaluating this? I mean, what does a pathologist look like to evaluate grades? Well, some grades are sort of determined by what the lesion is. For example, a pilocytic astrocytoma is, by definition, grade 1, although the pilomyxoid variant that occurs generally in somewhat younger patients has been now classified as a grade 2 to indicate the fact that this is perhaps more likely to grow quickly or to spread than the classic pilocytic astrocytoma. Otherwise, the pathologist has to look at the lesion and make an estimate as to the grade on the basis of certain histologic features, other microscopic features as seen with a microscope. This centers largely on what are known as mitoses. And mitoses are cells that are in the act of dividing. Critical to the formation of a mass, of course, is cells divide. Normal cells in the brain don't divide very much at all, but tumor cells do to a greater or lesser extent. And that is how a neoplasm forms. The definition of a neoplasm is basically an uncontrolled growth of cells. Cells in our body, of course, at all times in various organs are dividing to reproduce, replace ones that are shed. And that obviously is a very controlled process. Tight regulations are put on these cells so they do not do what they do in a neoplasm. And that is to proliferate without control and do not forming the normal tissues. So much of the interest in oncology from the scientific or molecular point of view is to determine what goes wrong with these cells, why the cells that shouldn't be dividing, why are they dividing, and if normal cells are normally dividing, what makes them go haywire and keep dividing when they've produced more cells than they're supposed to. So mitotic activity, then, is really the principal criterion. In other words, we look to see, well, how many mitoses are there in this tumor? And we usually do this, and in a semi-quantitative way, we look at an area under the microscope and count them, basically. And then we may look someplace else and count those, and we add up, say, for example, 10 areas and add up the numbers and say this lesion has, say, 8 mitotic figures per 10 fields. And there are standards that have been established through the years that give us some idea that, well, if a lesion has more than, say, 4 mitoses per area, that's, we know, will be a more aggressive lesion, and that can be used in the attempt to decide whether this is grade 2 or grade 3, for example. There are multiple other histological features. Of course, it's not only mitotic figures, but that is one of the principal mechanisms. Some of you, or children that are in the grade 2 to grade 3 range, or transitioning from grade 2 to grade 3, will have heard about some of the markers for this, the MIB, MIB1 or KI67 index, this is a means we have of labeling cells that are more or less in the proliferative. And that can be then these number of nuclei or cells that are positive can be determined, and this can be used in grading. So in certain circumstances, the MIB-1 or the Ki-67 index is a critical finding or an analysis which helps decide where to place the neoplasm as far as the grade. The question that comes up often is, well, what is a low-grade tumor, and how does this differ from a high-grade tumor? Well, the higher the grade, obviously, the more inferior is the outlook. And in general, the more assertive treatments need to be. By convention, low-grade tumors are grade 1 and grade 2, and high-grade tumors are grade 3 and grade 4. There is, of course, much more to this than just grades. A common grade 4 tumor, the medulloblastoma, is, in the majority of instances, cured with radio and chemotherapy, where some low-grade tumors, some pilocytic astrocytomas even, but more often another kind of astrocytoma, so-called grade 2 astrocytoma, may be ultimately be fatal. So, again, it depends on the tumor type, the location, et cetera. So grading is important. It's part of the treatment, but the outcome really depends on multiple variables, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So the question of how do benign and malignant terms differ from low-grade and high-grade? Well, low-grade are more toward the, quote, benign side, remembering that we don't like particularly to use the term benign tumors for something which is such a vital structure as the central nervous system. Malignant, again, can be used as a synonym for high-grade, but certainly other lesions that are low-grade are also biologically can be malignant. Now, the lesions that are commonly graded are most brain tumors, but you'll often hear of low-grade gliomas and high-grade gliomas. The question is, what are those? Well, the low-grade gliomas are grades 1 and grade 2, and these would include ependymomas that are in that grade, astrocytomas. The classic low-grade glioma is the pilocytic astrocytoma, which is its own entity. It has a grade 1 and rarely, if ever, becomes anything other than that. Basically, it's a grade 1 slowly growing, sometimes well-circumscribed, and remains thus way even after 30 or 40 years. It will change very little, if not actually slow down and stop growing, or in some cases, when they're small, can actually regress and disappear. High-grade gliomas, of course, this is not the case, and they will continue to grow, and if they're not fully high-grade, can become even higher grade, that is to go from a 3 to a 4. Ependymomas are also graded. These are usually, by convention, a 2 if they're low-grade, and then if they are or become more aggressive, can become a 3. And the treatments in some locations can depend on the grade in the ependymomas. In other parts of the brain, the treatment is similar, and the grade is not a major, does not have a major impact on treatment. Now, a question comes up always, well, this tumor is low grade, grades 1 or 2, can this become a high-grade tumor? Can the ependymoma that is now grade 2, if it comes back, can it come back as a higher grade and become more difficult to deal with? And the answer in that situation is yes. And the astrocytic tumors, as I've indicated before, the pilocytic lesions are maybe almost unique in the fact they seem very stable and remain grade 1 through decades in most cases. Occasionally there are exceptions, but these are quite unusual. Now, the one circumstance of which lesions can progress or increase in grades are the kind of astrocytoma which are more infiltrative, invading surrounding tissues, and when low-grade are graded a 2. The term diffuse astrocytoma is sometimes used for these. They're not uncommon in the brainstem, deep in the brain, in the thalamus in particular. These lesions as grade 2 are certainly prone through the years to become higher grade. They can begin as a 2 and later show features on the MR scan, for example, or rapid growth. that these are looking more aggressive and become a 3, and if not a 4 then or at a later date. So this group is of great concern, of course, but it's been thus far difficult, if not impossible, to predict when or if this transformation from low grade to high grade takes place. Of course, there's a lot of interest in laboratories, et cetera, to identify features which would tell us which one this is going to happen, and perhaps these patients could be treated earlier with radiotherapy and then spare that treatment at the time for lesions which had a low propensity to become more aggressive. But this is a subject of ongoing research. Right now, our tools are fairly unsophisticated in that sense. We can identify the tumor, but we can't do too much to predict how it will behave. Some lesions are already grade 4 and hard for them to get worse, but some medulloblastomas do seem to become even more aggressive and even more difficult to treat. But there is no grade 5. Now, you will hear the word anaplastic, and people ask, well, what is anaplastic, or what is anaplasia, the noun? Well, anaplasia is the pathologist's description of, in a sense, a lesion which looks little like the tissue from which it has arisen. The cells are very crowded, jumbled up, do not form normal structures, and typically have many mitotic figures and a high proliferative rate as seen by MIB-1 or Ki-67 staining. The term is variably used in different entities and is not always easy to define precisely. A common variety of anaplastic lesion would be an anaplastic or grade 3 ependymoma. A subset of medulloblastomas becomes highly anaplastic and at that point are highly aggressive. This is something recognized by a light microscope, but also now by a number of genetic changes which are commonly being used. So the pathologist's job first is then to find out, to tell you what kind of tumor it is, whether it's glioma, and if it's a glioma, whether it's astrocytic tumor, and if it's astrocytic tumor, what kind. Pilocytic astrocytoma, for example, at one end, or glioblastoma at the other end, which is an astrocytic tumor of a different type and a grade 4 lesion. The next question is to put this into the grading system. As I said, indicated before, some lesions are graded just by telling you what type they are. Pilocytics are grade 1. Medulloblastomas are grade 4. But even then, we can stratify patients to a certain extent within individual grades. The next thing that pathologists do, to a certain extent, is to ask the question, well, do these spread, or how is the lesion spread in my child? And in other body sites, the pathologist has a very critical role because they are given tissue from around a neoplasm and asked by the oncologist and the surgeon to determine whether this lesion has spread or not. A common example is when lymph nodes are provided adjacent to breast cancer or in the abdomen with colon cancer. It's the pathologist's job to look at these, determine whether tumor cells are present, whether the lesion has spread. Our role in the central nervous system is much less limited. We occasionally are given tissue and asked, is this, for example, tissue which is spread from the medulloblastoma to the spinal cord, or ependymoma which has spread in the cerebrospinal fluid. Generally, however, spread is evaluated in the central nervous system by radiologic features and clinical features. Often it's the radiological features. And it's for this reason, or among other reasons, why scans are done periodically after the initial treatment. This, of course, would analyze the area the tumor was or still is, the site that it arose, but also will be looking for spread elsewhere. This is especially true in lesions such as the PNETs, medulloblastoma, and the ependymomas, which are prone to spread within the cerebral spinal fluid. It's uncommon for lesions of the brain and spinal cord in children to spread outside the nervous system, like to bone or liver, what have you. It occurs every so often, but this is, generally speaking, not a concern, and there's not great attempts to evaluate the possibility that lesions have spread, say, to the lungs, as would be the case in lesions such as cancers outside the nervous system. Now, with all that in mind, then a diagnosis is reached. The lesion is seen clinically, producing something, or in some cases picked up incidentally. The location is noted, the radiologic features are evaluated, the decision to operate is made, and the tissue is obtained in both cases. Although the one lesion, the brainstem astrocytoma or brainstem gliome, is commonly not operated since the findings are clinical and radiologic examinations are so typical. So tissue is submitted, lesion is identified, it's given a name as best as possible. Recognizing that in children there are a fair percentage of lesions which are very difficult to classify. And of course this makes it very difficult to determine therapy if we're not really sure what it is and what grade it is. So then a treatment plan arises in consultation with all the interested parties and go from there. In some cases the treatment is nothing, just so-called observation, just watch. Repeat the scan, usually initially at 3 months, and see what happens. In the case of many pilocytic astrocytomas, they grow very slowly, and it would not anticipate that anything would happen within that period. High malignant lesions, grade 3 lesions, or 4 lesions, are generally treated generally with radiation and with chemotherapy, the type and extent of the treatment being dependent on the type of the lesion. Medulloblastomas are well known to have a tendency to spread in the cerebral spinal fluid, so these lesions are frequently treated, are usually treated with radiation of the whole nervous system, basically, if the patient is old enough to accept that form of treatment. Other lesions like ependymomas or most gliomas will be treated only to the area of the tumor itself, depending to a certain extent on the type of the neoplasm. Now, questions come up, why are they suggesting chemo or radiotherapy for what's a low-grade or a benign tumor? Well, some of these, as we said, indicated earlier, some of the things that are, from a pathologist's perspective, low-grade, grade 1 or grade 2, or benign in the very most general sense of the word, are in a very critical spot, and they may grow only slowly, but this could be very detrimental. So there are circumstances, and some pilocytic astrocytomas, for example, with some form of treatment, often initially chemotherapy, then sometimes radiotherapy, at a later date are indicated to control the growth of a lesion which has not been excisable because of the location. So, as we said earlier, the treatment of these depends on many factors, not just the pathologist's analysis of whether this is low-grade or high-grade or benign or malignant. Another question comes up, well, why are some malignant tumors or grade 4 lesions cured and other that are low-grade are not? In part, that depends on the susceptibility of the tumor cells to the treatment. Medulloblastoma, for example, is a very rapidly growing lesion on its own, would spread and grow quickly, but it is responsive to radiotherapy. So in patients in which this has not spread, perhaps 80% of the patients are cured by this treatment. Pilocytics, on the other hand, very slowly growing, are not particularly responsive to treatments that can continue to grow, albeit slowly, and in a sense be more aggressive in the long run than a lesion which is grade 4. There are other lesions like the so-called germ cell tumors or germinomas, which are a classic type of tumor, are in themselves rather proliferative and grade 4 malignant, but are highly susceptible to chemotherapy and radiotherapy, and in, given the right subtype, are cured almost routinely. So you can see that it's important to get an accurate diagnosis of what the tumor is before a treatment is instituted. As I indicated earlier, in children there are unfortunately a fair percentage of lesions which we just can't classify. And not only can't classify, we sometimes can't grade them. So this puts the oncologist in a very difficult position. What do we do with a lesion? We just can't tell you what it is or how aggressive it is. So this treatment there is a bit more difficult than it is when we have a better idea of what we're dealing with. And the question then, well, the treatment has been given, on what does the prognosis depend? Well, it depends on, generally speaking, on the extent with which it's excised. Obviously, even if it's highly malignant and it's all removed, it's cured. There's some malignant tumors of the choroid plexus, which is the tissue, part of the tissue in the hollow part of the brain and the fluid. In fact, the choroid plexus makes the fluid. That can be quite proliferative and qualify as, you know, grade 3 or 4, but can be excised since they often, at least early on, are very well circumscribed. So the patient shows up, there it is, the surgeon takes it out. Pathologist calls it, you know, malignant, but it's been removed in toto, and the patient is cured. So here you have a grade 4 lesion, some of them potentially cured by surgery alone. Throughout most of the tumors, the central nervous system, the extent of resection is a very critical prognostic factor. This has always been recognized, but it's been even more recognized in the recent years, and attempts are made increasingly to be sure that as much tissue is removed as is possible. Now, that's true for most lesions, but there are others in which this has really never been shown to be the case, and the surgeons are going to be less enthusiastic about attempting a total resection since they know they basically can't get this all out because of the extent to which it has infiltrated tissues. If there's tumor left behind, and this it's what will happen in a sense, it depends on the growth rate of what that tumor is. If this is a very slowly growing lesion like many pilocytic astrocytomas, then the lesion will grow slowly and in some cases stabilize, if not even regress in rare instances. So this clearly is important. High-grade lesions, and proliferative lesions, you can expect that the tumor left behind will grow quickly, and that clearly has a prognostic impact, and this is one of the reasons why we grade tumors. If the lesion were all removed, it really wouldn't make any difference what grade it was, or if there were treatments that could be given that would cure these without respect to grade, that would be nice, and we would not have to worry so much about these cells. And then the third issue is the sensitivity of what residual tumor cells to the treatment. We assume that when the surgeon takes out a medulloblastoma in toto, there probably are cells left behind that cannot be seen on the imaging, but as I said earlier, these are generally, if they're not very high grade, are responsive to radiotherapy and chemotherapy. So even though the tumors left cells left behind, they are sensitive to the treatment, and many of these patients are therefore cured. Other lesions, particularly the very slowly growing low grade tumors, are often rather not very responsive to treatments. Treatments are generally a little more effective in the more malignant lesions, rapidly growing tumors, than the slowly growing ones. So these treatments may have little immediate effect on such lesions as pilocytic astrocytoma, although they may, and in many cases one has to accept the fact that treatment is not going to cure the lesion, but it will retard it from growing. So it's not as exciting, but at the same time, it is a beneficial effect to keep it from getting bigger, as opposed to removing it entirely. So extended resection is important. Whether there's growth rate or what's left is critical. And then, of course, the sensitivity to what is left, if there is any, to the treatments becomes definitive. And the question is, well, how do you all know what extent of the tumor has been removed by the surgeon? This, like I said earlier, occasionally we're asked as pathologists to look at this and tell the surgeon and oncologist whether the thing was all out, but generally speaking, this is done by looking at the neuroimaging after the surgery and comparing that with what was seen before the operation. This obviously has its limitations. The MRI scan is not a microscope, so it doesn't see individual cells by any means, but it gives an idea of what has been removed, and that is then, of course, considered in light of what the surgeon says he or she saw at the time of surgery. But generally, it's a measure of the post-operative imaging. In some tumors, evaluation of the cerebral spinal fluid is done then or before surgery to get some idea whether tumor cells are floating in the fluid and give an idea as to the extent of the disease. So what happens then if all the tumor is not removed? Well, that, of course, obviously depends, again, on the whether type of tumor and responsiveness, et cetera. In some cases, tumor is clearly left behind, but it really never grows. This grows very slowly or responds to treatment to stabilize it, if not cure it. In other cases, of course, it will continue to grow. Now, a question comes up occasionally, actually more than occasionally probably, about the accuracy of the pathology diagnosis. And one can hope that this is a scientific process, that all pathologists are equally experienced, and they all make the same diagnosis on the same specimen. Now, this is certainly not the case, and it's not uncommon for different diagnoses to be rendered on the same tumor at different institutions. Yes, in some cases this is a minor issue. It's more of a terminology issue than it is anything of substance. But certainly there are cases where there's a significant difference. The lesion is thought to be low-grade at one institution but high-grade at something else, or one tumor type at one institution and another tumor type at another. And these can make big differences in the prognosis and the appropriate treatment or the timing of follow-up. And you can wonder, well, how can this happen? Well, it happens because this is diagnosis of tumors is, to a certain extent, an art rather than a science. Actually, it's largely art to a certain extent. Some pathologists are more experienced in these lesions. Others see pediatric tumors relatively infrequently, and it's, of course, more difficult for them to make a correct diagnosis. The size of the specimen is important. Some specimens can be quite small, as you can imagine, and that certainly makes things difficult. And it may mean that the lesion is not clearly one type or other, and an educated guess, if that's the word for it, may need to be done to come to the right diagnosis, or at least a working diagnosis for treating purposes. Now, what do you do if you get different diagnoses? This is a commonly asked question, and the answer is if it's a significant difference, you can ask the oncologist, the surgeon, what have you, what he or she recommends, but certainly getting a second opinion is a very reasonable option. We wouldn't hesitate to get second opinions about other things in life, and there's certainly no reason that you shouldn't do it with something so vital as the exact type of a tumor. If there is any differences, one could argue cogently that you could ask for a second opinion even if there weren't differences, or some people would suggest or do get asked for second opinions of their children's cases regardless of the diagnosis. To them, this is just too important an issue to rest in the hand of one observation, and would just, as a matter of course, insist that another person look at these files. And that's certainly not unreasonable, although I'm not suggesting that this is necessary or that certainly I'm any better than the other pathologists, but certainly getting other opinions is not a bad idea. Again, not depending on the circumstances. And your last question I would answer here today is, how do I get a second opinion? First of all, you should not feel hesitant or guilty about it. I know it's awkward for some people to ask for this. It feels like this is suggesting some lack of confidence in the system. I guess in one sense it is, but on the other hand, these are very important issues, and if the treatment, if active treatment is underway being considered on the basis of the specific diagnosis, this is totally reasonable to make sure that the diagnosis is correct, or at least as correct as possible, and ask for this be reviewed by someone else. Who that person is really up to you and the oncologist. There are certainly many neuropathologists around the country that we will need to look at it. I personally would be happy to look at it, but this is not a recruiting effort on my part to see more specimens by any means, but certainly people like myself are experienced and willing to look at these second opinions. So I hope this has been helpful. I try to give you the view of neuro-oncology in regard to pediatric tumors. This is obviously from the perspective of a pathologist, and don't claim to be a clinician, but I hope that I've been able to put this in a way that you'll find useful. And I would, of course, be glad to speak to any of you individually if you would wish to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Berger, for that powerful and thought-provoking informative presentation. It was critical material for all of us. We hope that it clarified any questions you had regarding the diagnosis of pediatric central nervous system tumors. Childhood Brain Tumor Foundation and Children's Brain Tumor Foundation, thank you for joining us for our webinar. If you have questions, feel free to call either organization for additional information. Now that you have the information regarding the diagnosis, you may want to listen to the second part of the series entitled New Treatment Advances with presenter Dr. Roger Packer. In an effort to continue to bring you vital information on topics pertinent to children with brain tumors, their families, and professionals, we will continue to offer webinars on related topics. Currently, there are a variety of teleconferences available for replay on our website with information from national experts. You may listen free at any time. To ensure this educational program and its information is helpful, please complete the survey attached to this link on our website. We look forward to your comments and continued involvement in our program. This concludes our webinar. Thank you for participating.